The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin with a photo caption. So let me read that. It's a picture of an ice climber, and then it says, "Armed with ice picks, this ice climber is midway up a frozen waterfall. The view is upward, and the ice and the gray vertical gray rock walls are juxtaposed against a blue sky." Well, quite an interesting picture there, huh? The photo is part of a story that's headlined "The Zen of Ice Climbing," written by Elaine Glusak, and the story appeared in the January 26, 2026 issue of the New York Times. Ms. Glusak tells us about a trip to Wyoming and how she, as a novice, learned to climb a frozen waterfall, an activity that takes focus, fearlessness, and a good axe, her words. Now let's hear her story, okay? So we'll go to Elaine's story. "As I inched up a frozen waterfall in the outskirts of Yellowstone National Park, kicking my crampon spikes into milky columns of ice and swinging an axe above my head, I heard just one thing over my own breathing, the tapping of a woodpecker that matched my cadence. Sweating in 40-degree weather, clinging to the vertical pitch and feeling time stand still, I took the sound as a Morse code encouragement. Last March, I traveled to Cody in northwestern Wyoming and then drove 90 minutes with my instructor, Zach Lynch, the owner and lead guide of Wyoming Mountain Guides, to this site in the Shoshone National Forest east of the park. Now, here I would try my hand and legs at climbing a 70-foot tall curtain of ice that curled over a stone ledge. A winter enthusiast, I'll try any sport that allows me to spend time in the snow without shivering. Compared with activities like cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, and skating, ice climbing requires a greater investment given the gear and the conditions required. On the promise of wild ice and wilderness, I enrolled in a one-day private ice climbing lesson with Wyoming Mountain Guides, for which she paid, by the way, she puts this in parentheses, $346.50. We continue with the story. "Anyone with an appreciation for winter would love it," said Aaron Mulkey, a professional climber based in Cody with nearly 300 first ascents to his name. "Every ice fall forms different each winter," he said. "In North America, ice climbing routes may open in fall when sparse snow makes it easier to reach ice. By March, deep snowpack and warming daytime temperatures add to the adventure. Ice climbing destinations can range from man-made parks like the one in Ouray in southwestern Colorado to natural climbs like a frozen waterfall near downtown Quebec City. I chose Cody, an adventure town and cultural hub some 50 miles from Yellowstone's eastern entrance, after talking to Mr. Mulkey, who moved there in 1997 to explore the many climbs in the area, including those in the South Fork of the Shoshone River Valley just southwest of Cody. Ouray is like going to the ski resort," he said. "The South Fork is like going backcountry skiing." Now we're going to the next section, heading to the vertical world. "For our late season lesson, Mr. Lynch suggested the backcountry closer to Yellowstone when we met at 7 a.m. at City's Table in Cody," that's a restaurant, "to grab coffee for the commute in his Toyota Tacoma. En route, he said that about half of the beginners he teaches have some rock climbing experience. For the other half, ice climbing is their first foray into the vertical world. I have rock climbed painfully in the past, confounded by routes dictated by walls with hand tools the width of a pencil. With ice, climbers have more control, creating their own routes with tools while using their legs for stability and holding on to bigger things such as axe handles. Tendon strength strength which is necessary in rock climbing is harder to acquire, Mr. Lynch said. You use big muscles in ice climbing. Our drive took us over plateaus in view of snow-capped mountains and down into river canyons and pine forest. Herds of deer grazed close to the road where the snow had receded to reveal muddy grass. There's more wildlife than people here, and the geology is very rugged, he said. It's a great place to come and get away from the crowds. We picked up a snowmobile for the last third of a mile as we headed into the wilderness on a seasonal road that approaches the national park and is closed to wheeled traffic in winter. After a short commute, we left the sled beside the trail, grabbed our backpacks, and hiked up a snowy hill into the forest. I followed Mr. Lynch's steps precisely for fear of falling into a tree well or another hole hidden under the knee-deep snow. After 15 minutes, we turned a corner to find a blemish-free drape of north-facing ice, pale blue in the shade, and dropped down to its base to begin gearing up for the ascent. Required gear, which my outfitter supplied, included crampons, helmet, harness, ice axes, and La Sportiva's climbing boots with rigid ankle support and stiff soles to withstand kicking the ice. And there's an image that shows up at this part of the story. It's a man with a beard, and he's wearing a hard hat, blue jacket, and a belt heavy with ice-climbing equipment, and he's standing behind a frozen waterfall. And that waterfall is described as white and green ice, like a pleated wall. Interesting, huh? So, back to our story. To learn to use the equipment, we ducked behind the ice into a cave between the falls and the rock wall that would become our practice chamber. Jamming his toes into the ice, Mr. Lynch demonstrated proper body placement, which is roughly a triangle with feet evenly distributed at the base and one hand on an axe driven into the ice overhead. Climbers first move one foot up by kicking their crampons into the ice, then bringing their other foot roughly to parallel before swinging the axe in their free hand overhead. Now, climbers throw their axes with force at concave depressions in the ice, which tend to be strong. As we discussed ice composition, Mr. Lynch suggested looking for air pockets in the concavities, which would be easier to penetrate. He compared the kind of animal knowledge that hunters develop to the understanding that ice climbers require. Now, concavities, by the way, are concave surfaces. So if you're running your hand over a smooth surface and it dips a little bit, that's a concave, just to give you an idea of what they're talking about. Now, we have another quote here from Mr. Lynch. He says, to be an effective bow hunter, you end up developing these really intimate relationships with animals, he said. And he says, ice is like that, where to do it well, you need to know how ice forms and what's good structure. Now, we move on to the next phase. It's called Zen on Ice. Introductory ice climbing does not delve deeply into the ice screws, ropes, and carabiners required to set a route, which Mr. Lynch handled, securing a rope to a tree at the top of the climb. We used a top rope belay system in which, as a climber ascends, the partner on the ground gathers the slack in the rope, which is threaded through a simple piece of hardware called a belay device, this to create friction. Now, putting downward pressure on the rope stops a climber's fall. Demonstrating the ascent, Mr. Lynch moved smoothly up the ice face, leaving axe holes I could jab into if my own attempts to find solid targets failed. When it was my turn, my focus on the vast outdoor landscape shrunk to workspace just a foot before me. I felt comfortable kicking the ice, but was surprised how often I couldn't find purchase and had to kick harder. Swinging the axes above my head grew tougher with every tap and heave as ice shards rained down into my face. I can't tell you how long it took, but by the time I took a break to look down, I realized I was closer to the end than the beginning. I would have to finish. With the last percussive push-up and onto the top of the frozen river in tempo with the unseen woodpecker, I felt exhilarated with achievement. As I rappelled down, Zach congratulated me on climbing what turned out to be intermediate ice. But I can't take full credit. According to Mr. Lynch, it just speaks to the accessibility of ice climbing. where to try ice climbing. Now, this is a part of the story where our author is offering some tips, if you're interested. And she writes about some of the more interesting places. Montmorency Falls in Quebec City freezes in winter to create a more than 270-foot tall wall that has long attracted ice climbers. And by the way, figure out 27 divided by 10, which is your average story, so that's 27 stories tall. An indoor climbing gym, Rock Gyms, offers introductory ice climbing excursions to the falls from an early January to mid-March. Now, five-hour excursions culminate in supervised climbs, and these prices start at $119 Canadian. That's about $87 U.S. In the Canadian Rockies, the region in and around Banff National Park is known for its frozen falls and ice walls. The outfitter Banff Adventures offers full-day beginner group classes. Now, these are $239.99 per person. Private tours are $838 for two people. Now, conditions dictate climbing locations, which might include a pitch called Junkyards near Canmore or King Creek, or all near Kanaskis County, or country. Now, in southwestern Colorado, Ouray Ice Park floods a nearly 2-mile stretch of the Uncombahray Gorge in winter, which produces more than 150 ice climbing routes, draws climbers from around the world, and holds an annual ice climbing festival. And so that sounds like fun. It's all in January, by the way. Now, several companies teach ice climbing in the nonprofit park, both San Juan Mountain Guides for $599, excluding your travel expenses, and then there's Base Camp Ouray, which is $559, and that excludes travel expenses. They offer two-day introductory courses. Moxie Mountain Guides offers day-long introductory courses from $365 and up. Now we go to New Hampshire, where ice climbers can head to Mount Washington Valley, where the International Mountain Climbing School's guided trips include an 8-hour private class suitable for beginners. This is for $385. It also runs the annual Mount Washington Valley Ice Fest, February 5th to 8th this year, which offers clinics for all abilities, gear demos, and athlete talks. Now, based in Stanley, Idaho, Sawtooth Mountain Guides offers private lessons around Ketchum, and from mid-November through mid-February. It's limited to two people. Eight-hour sessions cost you $675. That's for one person, or $390 each for two people. So there you go. That's Elaine Glusak's foray into ice climbing. By the way, Elaine is the New York Times frugal travel columnist, and she's always focusing on budget-friendly trips and journeys, and some things eclectic when it comes to travel, so always fun to read what she has to offer. So, our next story is from the February 3rd, 2026 issue of the Washington Post. In its headline, Grandma's First Trip to Disney World is Social Media Gold. Now, the editors add, you never forget your first time at Disney World, especially if you're 78. The writer is Hannah Sampson. We've featured many of her articles in the past. And now here's her latest story about Grandma's trip to Disney World. Now, Grandma Sue, also known as Suzanne Warnick, waits for a parade at Disneyland with her daughter and four granddaughters during the July trip. From left, she has Emily Kakusko, Warnick, Brenda Rakushia, and Meredith Williams, Rachel Dragon, and Heidi Francis. These are the pictures of these kids that went on this trip. Now, here's Hannah's story. The Disney World first-timer waved at Tigger, grinned for photos with Cinderella, and faced down stormtroopers on a Star Wars ride. Just two princesses living their best lives in Disney World, wrote Caitlin Donut on a video she made on the October trip. I love you. Happy 78th birthday. Now for Barbara DeWitt, mama to 31-year-old Caitlin, a medical esthetician, the trip was a highlight that included her first time on a plane, and with nearly 5 million views on TikTok, the Kentucky duo's experience was a viral example of a trend that has proliferated on social media. media in recent years. A generation of Disney adults planning trips with Grandma. We had a great time, Barbara DeWitt said. I've told older people, I said, go with a grandchild, whatever one time. It'll be the best time of your life. Well, grandparents have long taken their grown children and grandkids on theme park vacations, navigating tantrums and nap times, picky appetites, and stroller parking. Now those adult grandkids are flipping the script, planning meals where grandparents can meet characters, rides that meet their thrill tolerance, and plenty of photo opportunities. In videos on social media, grandmas and a couple of grandpas cheer during fireworks, dab tears while meeting Snow White, beam during parades, dance with Pinocchio, laugh on roller coasters, and show off mouse ear headbands. Commenters say they confess to sobbing. And by the way, there is an Instagram to follow Caitlin DeWitt, and it's at Caitlin, KAITLYN.DOUHITT. And she says, it's just two princesses living our best lives in Disney World. And she has several hashtags, Happy Birthday Grandma, Disney Magic, and Walt Disney World. And then she continues, I would give anything to be able to experience this with my grandma, one person wrote in response to a video of a teary grandma declaring her trip the best time I've had in a long time. Next section says she became a kid. Suzanne Warnick, 82, had chaperoned high school marching band trips at Disneyland when her daughters were teens but had not visited in decades. Then one of her granddaughters dropped an idea in a group chat with her sisters. I really just want to go to Disneyland with Grandma Sue. A few months later, in July, Warnick and her daughter and her four granddaughters left spouses and kids behind, and they decided to road trip from Utah to Southern California. They made T-shirts for the occasion, a woman who looked like Grandma Sue sitting in an oversized teacup with the phrase, Grandma's Wild Adventure. Before the trip, Rachel Dragon, one of those granddaughters, worried how her grandma would do on rides. Now, Warnick had to figure out a solution to her portable oxygen needs and necessities since she underwent radiation treatment for breast cancer. The family wondered how Warnick would do on a scooter. They needn't have worried. With our hands full with her, Dragon said, laughing, Warnick just went on about every ride available, including a log flume with a 50-foot drop, a bumpy roller coaster ride, and an attraction that includes free falls. Imagine that, huh? Dragon took videos of Grandma's wild adventure, including efforts to keep up with the scooter, a simulated hang gliding experience that Grandma did not enjoy, and the group's hysterics while getting soaked on a water ride that ruined Warnick's fresh perm. This is literally the best thing of my life, said Dragon, 31, a travel agent, content creator, and Etsy shop owner. She's my last grandparent remaining, so I just want to get all of the time that I can with her. Well, Warnick said the trip was the highlight of my senior years. Her husband died in 2019, and she has dealt with health challenges in recent years. Being a widow, I just hadn't done anything fun, she said. As a workaholic before retiring as a court reporter, she said she hadn't revealed such a carefree side to her own daughter. It's just really so crazy how this trip showed us a new grandma, Dragon said in an email. She really was alive and the happiest I've seen in years, if not ever. She became like a kid that I've never seen. Childlike wonder. The Walt Disney Company is keen to encourage visitors from all generations, though kids are the obvious audience, and Disney adults get outsized attention. Now, we want to be the place where every generation can make memories they'll talk about for years to come, and it's extra special to see the joy that grandkids get by bringing their grandparents to Disney so that they can be kids again, the company said in a statement. A couple of years ago, Disney offered to host Gavin Doyle, the founder of the news and tip site Mickey Visit, and family members on a trip to Disneyland to share what a multi-generational trip to Disneyland can look like. He wrote on the site, he said in an interview that the company was looking to showcase the childlike wonder that older visitors can experience. Doyle, now 28, brought his 85-year-old grandma, aunt, mom, and younger sister. His grandmother, Judy Blumenthal, had gone to Disneyland with him when he was four. Disneyland is a place where you can go and there is nostalgia, and it feels in some ways like it hasn't changed since 1955, even though it's changed so much, he said. So she was obviously having a great time seeing our fun and then also, oh, it's Mary Poppins. Doyle said his grandma's favorite rides remain the classics like Pirates of the Caribbean and It's a Small World. But he got her to ride the faster-paced Radiator Springs racers with him. She was just gripping my arm the whole time, Doyle said. He remembered her verdict, "That was about as much as I could take." Tips for grandparent trips. Elaine Parrott, a planned Disney panelist, an independent contractor who provides tips for Disney guests, takes her 85-year-old in-laws to Disney World. In an email, she said visitors should let grandparents take a trip at their own pace. In her own family, she said, the matriarch likes to break off to enjoy a nostalgic ride while others hop on a roller coaster. Warnick, who used a rented scooter on her Disneyland trip, recommended the mobility aid for a demanding day of walking. Though she acknowledged the type of wheels would depend on the user. She doesn't use one in everyday life. Ashley Mealy, who visited Disney World last February with her mom and sister and grandmother to celebrate her Nan's 92nd birthday, said they took turns pushing the wheelchair because her grandmother wasn't comfortable with a scooter. These aren't always great because people can jump in front of them, she said. That can add to stressful experiences. Now, Mealy, 38, who works in corporate events for an insurance company, says she is adamant about taking time for photos. Last year, making it a priority to get group shots in front of that castle in the Magic Kingdom. I bet that was fun. She said it's good to know that what appetite the grandparent has for rides. Her grandmother, Mary Claire Friel, was on her fifth visit to the parks last year and knew she liked milder rides, not the crazy ones, as she puts it. Individual rides and online descriptions include accessibility information and health and safety warnings. And by the way, when Caitlin and Barbara Doit visited, their most exciting ride of the day, Rise of the Resistance, a Star Wars attraction, turned out to be Meemaw's favorite. Caitlin joked she wasn't going to try to get Barbara on the high-speed Tron-themed roller coaster. That'll be next, Grandma said. Oh, sounds like lots of fun. Well, as you already know, ice and snow have already come to North Carolina in recent weeks, and that's certainly in contrast to our usual winter fare of typically sunny or even partly cloudy skies. Temperatures sometimes in the upper 20s to 30s, but more often in the 40s. And there's even spring-like days, 50s and 60s, during these winter months. But for those who prefer real winter weather, especially snow, North Carolina can be a challenge, as we all know. But we are not alone. As this headline from the February 6, 2026 issue of the Washington Post reads, Rhode Island's last ski area faces an existential threat. No snow. It's written by Rachel Wisniewski. Now, her story centers around the Yawgoo Valley Ski Area, which opened its doors in 1965. At the time, there were four other ski areas in the state. Ms. Wisniewski explains that it's all about a change in weather patterns. So let us find out more about her experience there in Rhode Island. Okay. A skier travels down an advanced trail at Yawgoo Valley Ski Area, which is the only ski resort in Rhode Island. And this is a picture that accompanies this article in the Washington Post. Our dateline is Exeter, Rhode Island. There is a delicate art to creating snow, she writes. Not many know that better than Joe Marfio, 27, the head snowmaker at Yawgoo Valley Ski Area. The outside temperature can't be above 27 degrees, or it isn't cold enough for the water to freeze into the snow when it hits the air. If it's colder than 10 degrees, the water will start to freeze before it even does that, jamming the machine in the process. Humidity is another variable. For the past three winters, Marfio has worked overnights at Yawgoo from 7 p.m. to 8 a.m. whenever it's been possible to make snow. Many nights and even weeks, conditions make that impossible. Though this winter is quite cold, the past few years have been warmer and rainier, leading to significantly less snow and drastically shortened ski seasons. New England alone has lost hundreds of ski areas over the past several decades. Yawgoo Valley has long been the lone remaining ski resort in Rhode Island. In 2022 and 2023, Yawgoo was only able to keep one of its six top-to-bottom trails open. Though this winter has been a much better year for snow, the resort's Outback Trail has been closed all season because there hasn't been enough snow snow cover to safely open it. Snow tubing, which requires even more snow, has been closed as well. Last year was the first year in a long time that we had every single trail open, Marfio says. The variation in winter weather is a direct result of climate change. Rhode Island is the first state in the lower 48 whose average temperature has risen by more than 2 degrees Celsius since 1895. Now, over the past 5 years, the pace of New England's temperature rise has only continued to increase. Researchers Stephen and Joshua Young recently published findings in the journal Climate indicating that southern New England lost over 30 to 40% of its snow cover days between 2000 and 2025, one of the fastest declines in the world. The temperature rise in the Atlantic Ocean and New England's proximity to the coast are significant factors. Oceans store 90% of the excess heat trapped in the Earth's atmosphere by greenhouse gas emissions. One study published in the journal PLOS One suggested that all major skiing regions across the world will be affected by the end of this century, with 13% of ski areas projected to experience a 100% decrease in snow cover days. Devoted staff runs on goo vibes. Yagoo Valley opened in 1965. At the time, there were four other ski areas in the state. Maxwell DeWardner was there from the beginning, working as a ski instructor and even building the road that leads to the slopes. In 1980, he bought the place. Tracy Hartman, his daughter, was basically born here, she says, performing such jobs as selling lift tickets, taking out the trash, and working on the resort snack bar. She's now the CEO. Her husband, Clay, runs the outside operations. Her mother answers the phone in the office. If we didn't work together, we'd never see each other in the wintertime because we're always here, Hartman said. Joe Dagliaria, age 38, has worked the resort for 22 years. He's now one of the operations managers. His 5-year-old son has already taken 3 years of snowboarding and 1 year of skiing lessons. Danielle DeAndrea, 27, another operations manager, has been at Yagoo for 9 years. And for the past 2 years, she's even convinced her brother Brandon, who lives in Illinois, to fly out for the winter and help on the snowmaking team. People call it goob vibes, Hartman said, referring to Yagoo. There's a sense of family. There's a sense of friendship. I can't even describe how great it is. Next section, it's definitely getting warmer. Despite its small size, Yagoo has cultivated an immense presence in the local community over the past 60 years. Its 5-week learn-to-ski program has 1,300 kids enrolled and a waiting list. The resort has 375 season pass holders and can sell hundreds of daily passes. While most of their clientele is local, guests also travel from New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. The large draw is Yagoo's price. While lift tickets in nearby Vermont go for over $100, Yagoo's weekday admission is just $45. For many in Rhode Island, Yagoo is their only opportunity to ski or snowboard. The next closest ski resort is almost 2 hours away. If we weren't here, these kids would never be exposed to it, Hartman said. It's hard, but when you see everyone having fun, it makes it all worth it. Well, a sense of purpose has sustained y'all two for decades, but it's also what makes the resort's future increasingly worrisome as Yagoo stares down the barrel of climate change. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed listening and that you'll join us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.